Good evening. Good evening. Good evening. Good evening. Good evening. Have you all been having a lovely time this week? Yeah, marvelous. Marvelous. Right, tonight, you're in for a real treat. I have had such a lovely time getting to know my big brother this week. I thought it was going to be a pain in the ass. I thought, you know, me and him were going to get a war. But what a lovely big brother he is. It's been a real privilege, actually. Give you some acting as well. I wonder what that would look like if you were to do some more in a, I don't know, like in a legacy or something like that. That'd be pretty neat. Look, he's an incredibly talented human being. I know how much he means to so many of you. I had the great honour of being interviewed on a little show called The Reading Room, wasn't it? He's a lovely, lovely fellow. He's going to share some heartfelt moments with you. I think, I hope that you go on the journey with him tonight, because you know, we all go through a very interesting journey in our life. And I think his fascinating, and what he wants to share with you and invite you into his world, and for him to lay it bare and open with you tonight, I think is a real sign of bravery and candor, and it shows how much he cares about you all as well. So, ladies and gentlemen, no boys and girls, because it's not that sort of shit. My big brother.
If you had told me 45 seconds ago that I would be tearing up backstage hearing Ed call me his big brother, I would have been like, you're wrong. That's not gonna happen. Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for coming tonight. As you know, my name is Will Wheaton, and I'm a writer most of the time. And I have a memoir out right now called Still Just a Geek. And thank you. And this material that I'm going to share with you tonight kind of came out of that. Just two disclaimers before we get going. I am a survivor of child abuse and child exploitation. I didn't have a dad, I had a bully, I didn't have a mom, I had an incompetent manager I could not fire. I wasn't a member of a family, I was a thing who lived in a house with four other people, and it sucked all the time. Behind that reality, my mom really made me tell a story that was just absolutely not true about our family. And it was really, really hard to keep that lie straight forever and ever and ever. And turns out I have CPTSD in no small part because of that. And the stories that I'm telling tonight are two stories from when I was younger. I'll get into that in I do this thing where like I write a great introduction and then I say the whole introduction before I start to write it. So that's one. Another thing is my parents insist that none of this ever happened and I'm a giant liar. So there, that is my legal cover and disclaimer. Finally, these memories are extremely old. I've done my best to convey the emotional truth of the stories I am going to tell you tonight, but I'm sure some of these details are not perfectly accurate, and some of these details have been intentionally changed to protect and obscure the identities of people who do not live in public the same way that I do. So with that, I present to you, So I Turned Myself to Face Me, memories from and inspired by Still Just a Geek. Did not expect that, thank you. For most of 2022 and about half of 2023, I worked on and promoted my New York Times bestselling memoir, Still Just a Geek. A huge part of my story is my survival of child abuse and exploitation, and it's the part I never told in public. As I wrote in the epilogue of the book, I hoped that I would find some catharsis through the writing of it and the sharing of my story, but I actually just ended up re-traumatizing myself. I healed a little bit when I did the audiobook, and then I re-traumatized myself all over again when I did the promotional tour. At the end of what was about a two-year process, I noticed how much I had been picking at a barely healed wound. When the promotion cycle for the book wrapped up, I saw how raw and aggravated that wound had become. I gave myself permission to withdraw from public life as much as I wanted and needed to rest, regain my hit points. Now, for someone who has primarily existed online for this entire century so far, That was really weird. It was uncomfortable to sit quietly in that silent stillness, as far away from the public's eye as I could get, since my job has a rather significant public-facing aspect. I'd been resting for a couple of days when the panic attacks and the night terrors I thought I had banished came back. That is how I knew that this wound I was picking at had become infected, and it was time to go see a doctor. So I called the best doctor I know, my space mom. Via my space mom, I got a referral and I started EMDR therapy. I, fellow EMDR therapy enthusiasts in the audience, thank you. I did not want this infection to spread. It was tough, but we got the infection cleaned up. We broke the fever and we got me back on my feet. The wound is still there, but I am a daily active participant in helping to heal it. So one of the things I do as I am practicing my healing is make space to listen to my younger self. This part of me who was never heard or seen, who was drowning under the enormous emotional and financial burdens our mother put on our shoulders, while he was relentlessly bullied by our father, and was conditioned to believe that if he could just solve this puzzle that his mom had given him, then dad would love and accept him. What I didn't know then is that she didn't give me all the pieces. And I'm not sure that she was hiding them from me. I think she didn't have them all herself. So, I am doing the best I can to be the person I needed when I was him. And what I needed was someone to listen to me while I just told the truth, instead of that made-for-tiger-beat lie, because the disparity between the two was making me crazy. I said to my younger self, "Hey, buddy, I am an adult. I need you to know that we make it." As it turns out, I'm also a dad. And I am nothing like our dad. I am a loving dad. I cherish my children. You would love me so much if you knew me now, and I would love you right back. In fact, I do. I want you to know that I'm here for you, buddy. Check it out, I'm a professional writer now, of some note. I will tell your true story, if you will trust me to tell it. All you have to do is talk. You just talk. You just tell me what you remember. Just tell me how it felt. I will listen without judgment, and I will write it all down so that we can heal you together. It took so long for him to get started. A lot of false starts, a lot of crumpled up sheets of paper thrown across the room, reminders of how bad I am at basketball. He doubts himself. He questions himself. He is very quick to dismiss his feelings if they make someone else uncomfortable or if they contradict a narrative. His conditioning runs really, really, really deep. Now, this wasn't easy. Nothing worth doing ever is, but it was so worth it. And once he got started, he talked for hours, then days, and then weeks, and I wrote down every single word. We did that for about 30,000 words before we both really needed to take a break. I have not had the time or the spoons to apply my professional writer skills to the full rough draft, but I've done about half in between prepping and shooting episodes of my show, The Ready Room. Thing is, I thought that I had 90 minutes for this show tonight, and I don't. I only have 60. And I owe it to the childhood story I'm telling to not rush it, So I asked him, which one of these stories is the most important to you right now? You don't have to tell me why. You don't even have to know, and that's super okay. I'm going to begin with the piece that he picked. In the summer of 1981, my friend Jenny, who lived next door, had a friend from Northern California visit for a couple of weeks. Her name was Candace, and she went by Candy. She was my first and my biggest childhood crush. That summer, the Stars on 45 medley was blowing up. And whenever it came on my transistor radio, I would sing, "Sugar, ah, honey, honey, you were my candy girl!" From the deepest well of my little first crush having heart. Listen, you want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell? Maybe she would be my candy girl. Whatever that meant. Pretty sure it involved holding hands. I could sing the song right in front of her, and she totally didn't know. Delightfully devilish young Will. So we were playing in the sprinklers in Jenny's front yard when her mom called them in for lunch before they went to the zoo. The kids who lived next door, Jenny and her little brother Justin, all got the stuff that my brother and sister and I always wanted. Frosted Flakes, Kool-Aid, Ding Dongs, Otter Pops, all that stuff that's marketed to kids that I wasn't allowed to have because something, something sugar, here, have some Carob. It's exactly like chocolate, except it's waxy and flavorless and all kids hate it. Enjoy! Shout out to my fellow Carob survivors. It's the meanest practical joke this side of the giant unguarded bar of chocolate in the pantry that turns out is baking chocolate. Enjoy your sense memory, everyone. I went home to get something for myself and to figure out the rest of my afternoon until they got back. So with blades of grass stuck to my feet and legs, my hair smashed down by sweat and water, and this fluttering in my stomach that was new to me and not at all unpleasant, I ran out of the summer heat and into my house. The swamp cooler was doing its best to cool the house down, which left a lot to be desired, if I'm being honest. The swamp cooler was so good at making the house more humid than the humidest place on earth. Not great at cooling off the room. The kitchen was to my right. The living room was in front of me. And the hallway to our bathroom, to our bedrooms and the bathroom was to my left. My dad was in the kitchen, sitting at the table with his back to me. He was on the phone in the kitchen with the long cord, and he didn't notice me come in. It only took me a couple of seconds to figure out that he was talking to my uncle, who I thought was just the coolest dude on the planet. He was a surfer. He had Atari. I inhaled, preparing to ask my dad if I could say hi to him, when I heard that my dad was talking about me. He was telling my uncle that I had my first crush. And he was making fun of me about it, behind my back. He was laughing about how I didn't think anyone knew. He said something about how I was picking clothes out for the first time, choosing them carefully. I was brushing my hair, and I was singing this one song over and over. Now, to a normal parent, this is something that would be adorable and sweet. To my dad, it was a point of shameful weakness to be mocked. He was having a big laugh at my expense, and he was laughing with my favorite uncle. I was humiliated, I was embarrassed, and I was deeply hurt. I felt betrayed. I was instantly aware of my bare chest, my wet swimming trunks, my skinny legs and arms. I was overwhelmed by shame. I was so stupid. I had been making an ass of myself all summer long in front of everyone. And like the idiot my dad knew I was, I didn't think anyone knew. I cried out, "It's not true! That's not true! I don't! My dad jerked his head around and he looked across the kitchen at me. It has been 43 years. I can still see his face. He went from surprised to annoyed to laughing even harder. "Okay, cut," he said, like I was doing a scene, not expressing genuine feelings. This was one of his favorite ways to mock and belittle me when I was upset, and it worked every single time. I burst into tears. "Cut, cut, oh, print!" He put the phone between his shoulder and his ear and clapped his hands. I cried harder. "Stop it! Don't do that!" "Oh, you're so sensitive. Don't be so dramatic," he said sarcastically. And then into the phone. "Nothing. It's nothing." He walked out of the kitchen and into the dining room, the long cord slowly stretching out behind him, a single knot tightening where it sagged. After a moment, I ran to my bedroom. I threw myself onto my Star Wars bedspread, and I cried like I'd been beaten up by a schoolyard bully, which, well. My dad never came in to talk to me, to check on me, to like be a dad who loved his son. I brought this up to him when I was in my 20s, hoping for some resolution to a deeply, deeply painful moment in my life. He dismissed me then as being too dramatic, so points for consistency. I stayed in my room with my door closed, and I cried until I fell asleep. Eventually, my mom came home with my infant sister. I had the puffy eyes, the heavy chest, and that weird mouth feeling of sleeping too hard in the middle of the day. But I woke up when I heard the car pull into the driveway, the screen door open and close. I heard the keys drop into the bowl, followed almost immediately by the familiar yet inscrutable thrumming of voices coming through the walls as my parents argued, literally seconds after my mom stepped into the house. This happened almost every day, and I hated it. It was really upsetting. It felt unsafe. It felt chaotic. I never had friends over because I didn't want them to see my parents the way that I did. The anger between the two of them filled the air in our house with this faint, ever-present haze of resentment and power struggle. It was like emotional smog. Some days it was so thick I couldn't breathe. Other days it was barely visible. But it was always there, always poisoning everything. The voices got louder and more intense. Somebody slammed a cabinet and my sister began to cry. I heard that familiar mocking laugh, knew that it had been my mom who slammed the door. I heard heavy footsteps and my sister's crying got louder and closer as my mom carried her past my door and into my parents' bedroom at the end of the hall. She slammed their door so hard it shook the bookcase in my room. It was really scary. Lots of my friends had divorced parents. And when I saw parents on television behave the way mine did, they usually got divorced. Even though I secretly wished my parents would get a divorce, that was scary too. I thought about picking a parent to live with like some of my friends did. Most of them lived with their mom, which is what I would have done. She was forcing me to be an actor. She wouldn't let me be a kid. But at least she wasn't a bully to me like my dad was. She was alive, but at least she wasn't mean. It is totally normal for a 9-year-old kid to hope his parents will get divorced so he doesn't have to live in their angry chaos. It is equally normal for parents to think that their screaming, door slamming, wall kicking, and tantrum throwing is super okay and won't have a negative effect on their children. I pulled the covers around my head as tightly as I could to muffle the sounds of crying that I now wasn't entirely sure was only coming from my baby sister. Super normal, totally not traumatic. I didn't come out of my bedroom until it was time for dinner around 5. We all sat at the kitchen table, my sister in her high chair, my brother across the table from me, my parents on either side. We had goulash, sort of a family dinner, basically canned corn, ground beef, little bit of noodles, and just a lot of tomato-based sauce. I usually liked it. It was like a sloppy joe without the bun and corn for some reason. But the last thing I wanted to do then was eat. So I sat there and I pushed it around with my fork while my parents shyly seethed at each other and we all pretended not to notice. My brother and sister obliviously devoured their respective dinners. My brother finished, put his dish in the sink, and went to watch TV. Dad finished, left his plate on the table, and joined my brother. Mom began to clear his dish and looked at me. "What's wrong with your goulash?" I sensed an impending interrogation, and I did my best to avoid it. Nothing. It's fine. I'm just not very hungry. We looked at each other. Both of us, having just been run over by the miserable fucking bulldozer that was my father. "Please, please don't make me talk about it," I thought. "Okay, well, put it in the refrigerator and we'll warm it up for you later." I exhaled the breath I didn't know I had been holding. "Okay, can I go outside?" "Yes, just make sure that you come in when the streetlights come on." I got on my bike and I rode it up the street. I felt angry. I felt hurt, I felt confused and scared, but at least I was not inside with them. I stood up and I pushed the pedals as fast and as hard as I could. I wondered what it would be like if I just kept going and didn't come back. I wondered about that a lot when I was a kid. I got to the top of the street and I jumped the curb, rode down the sidewalk for a couple of houses, jumped off the curb, raced down the street as fast as I could, over and over, as hard as I could go, skidding to a stop as close to the end of the sidewalk as I could, leaving as much rubber behind as possible, up the street, around the cul-de-sac, power skid, then back down the street, another power skid. I was so good at riding my bike. Maybe if I got good enough at riding my bike, my dad would notice. Jenny's mom pulled her Ford Pinto wagon into their driveway as I sped past them on my way down the street. My heart skipped a beat, and I gripped the handlebars as professionally as I could. Stood up as tall as possible, and I pushed even harder on the pedals. I tensed my entire body until my bike and I were one. We were joined together at a spiritual level. We became a marble stallion that commanded the attention of all who were blessed by its presence. I aimed toward the edge of the nearest driveway so I could take a little jump off the curb, small flourish to let the audience know I appreciated them. Push, 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 pump those legs, Will, maximum speed. Get ready to lift those handlebars and soar, buddy. Now, a lot of you, right now, are expecting me to just wipe out. I totally get that. I have set it up thusly. It is a perfect time for a sad trombone. But I didn't. I fucking nailed it. I pulled off the sweetest jump, you guys. I got to the end of the street. I triumphantly slammed on my back and my front brakes. Double epic skid. Pretty sure it's still there. The kids who live there now whisper stories about the time the city repaved around it. I turned my bike around as slowly and cinematically as I could, ready to receive my tribute. Only they were still in the car. The doors had not yet opened. They missed all of it. And now, here is your sad trombone. Just like that, well done, all of my energy was gone. My arms and legs felt heavy and slow. I sat back onto my bike and pedaled toward my house. Jenny and Candy were waiting for me at the end of her driveway. They were both smiling and blushing. Oh, maybe they did see me. My brakes made this embarrassing squeak when I stopped next to them. I tried to like do that thing where you lean your bike to one side and very carefully, casually leave one foot just sort of resting on the pedal like I'd seen the big kids do on TV. What I managed to do was slide off the seat, spin the pedals around in a backwards loop, smash myself in the shin with one of them, and drop my bike to the ground underneath me. There is your second sad trombone. "Are you okay?" Jenny asked. "Oh, yeah," I said. I'm just riding my bike." They giggled. I think I'm getting pretty good at doing skids, I offered. Jenny suppressed a smile and Candy licked her lips. How was the Zoom? I asked.
It was good,
Jenny said, holding back most of the giggle.
Was she making fun of me?
Why was she laughing? She elbowed Candy, who I noticed had her hands behind her back. We saw the elephant exhibit, Candy said. They shared a conspiratorial glance. Go! Jenny whispered urgently. Okay! Candy whispered back. She took her hands from behind her back, and she shoved a gray plastic elephant into my hands. They have this machine that lets you make models, so I got you an elephant one. It came out like, they have this machine that lets you make models, so I got you an elephant one. It was damp and warm in my hands as I took it. I turned it over and glanced up at her. She was looking back at me expectantly. I didn't know what to do. I felt a little out of breath all of a sudden. Do you like it? She asked cautiously. That's what she said. Do you like it? What I heard was, do you like me? Yes! Yes! They both jumped back a little bit, then giggled. My face got hot. I mean, yes, yes, thank you. This is great. Jenny's mom called out from the porch, girls, come in and wash your hands to get the zoo off of them. Then you can come back out and play. Okay, mom. They hesitated. Candy and I looked at each other for like way too long. I can still see these really big, kind brown eyes. I really, really wanted to hug her. I didn't want to kiss her, that was gross. But a hug, that would be great. The Archie started to hum a little chorus in the back of my head. But what if my dad saw? What if Jenny's mom saw? What if she laughed at me? What if Jenny's mom told my parents? What if Candy doesn't like me that way? What if, welcome to the rest of your life, Will Wheaton. Let's go, girls, her mom said. They'll be right back, Will. We gotta go, Jenny said, like we were standing on a train platform in Paris in 1903. But we'll be right back. Okay. I dropped my bike on the ground and ran across the lawn. When I got to the edge of our garage, I hid the elephant under my shirt, and I looked around the corner. I could see my mom in the kitchen window. It looked like she was washing dishes. I waited for her to turn away and ran quickly and quietly up the driveway, avoiding her attention as I slipped into the house and sneaked down the hallway to my bedroom, avoiding the places where it squeaked. I closed the door behind me, and I looked for the perfect place to put Candy's elephant. Next to my bed was the most obvious place, but that felt weird. Too intimate is how I would have described it if I'd known what that word meant. My bookcase was pretty full, and all the space on top of my dresser was taken up with the Hoth Rebel Base playset I had that had Han Solo in the parka and Han Solo from Star Wars in it, because I really liked Han Solo. That left my desk, a recent addition to my bedroom set that was handed down from one of my cousins. I had real homework now. I was in fourth grade. So I sat at my desk, and I put it under my springy little lamp on the side that was furthest from the door. I clicked it on to create a spotlight. I looked at it, and I just smiled. Candy got this for me when she was at the zoo. She spent her own money on it. I heard heavy footsteps coming down the hall toward the bathroom. Cut! Cut! Print! You're so sensitive. Don't be dramatic. It's nothing. Oh, it's nothing. The laugh. I can still hear it today. I haven't seen him or heard his voice in almost 8 years. I hope I never do for the rest of my life. I grabbed Candy's elephant and I shoved it into the top drawer. I buried it under some papers to be sure nobody else would find it. I listened for him to walk back to the other side of the house and crept down the hallway until I could see my mom in the kitchen. I made sure she couldn't see me and sneaked back out of the house and around the corner of the garage. I dashed across the lawn. I wanted to skip so much, but even then I knew that wasn't cool. And I met them on Jenny's porch. We played Payday until the streetlights came on. I never hugged Candy. I never held her hand. I never told her that I liked her. She was only visiting for another week. And whenever I felt the impulse, the specter of my dad just got up in my face and I kept it all to myself. But I think she knew. Like, how could she not? How could the object of my crush be the only person on the Berthon Street in Sunland who did not know? I think she liked me too, because I had the elephant to prove it. It is now 7 years later. I am almost 16. This is right before I have my driver's license. We had moved from Sunland up to La Crescenta, and I was working on Star Trek. My mom and I were in my bedroom. She was making me go through my clothes. I had to go do a photo shoot for Tiger Beat, or Teen Face, or Non-Threatening Boys Magazine, or one of those. And she insisted on choosing all of my clothes for me. "This is so your fans can see your best self," she said. I wanted to wear a simple Oingo Boingo t-shirt. And she pulled out every button-down shirt I owned and then had me try it on just to be sure. It didn't take long before I was exhausted, worn down, and agreed to wear this horrible, trendy Chess King shirt that she got in the mall that fit her definition of my best self, but it very much fit my definition of complete tool bag and a bolo tie. On her way out of my bedroom, she looked at my desk. Next to my Macintosh 2, with its groundbreaking, futuristic 13-inch, 256-color monitor. Leave yourself some place to go, because I'm about to tell you that I had a massive 35 megabyte SCSI hard drive. It weighed about 18 pounds. It was roughly the size of two phone books. It was so big, it was the last hard drive I would ever need to buy in my life. Next to it was Candy's elephant. My mom zeroed in on it like the Terminator. "What's that? I've never seen that before." Why? Why was he so suspicious of me? Why did I have to constantly explain myself to her? Why was she so fucking needy all the time? It's an elephant. I can see that. Where did it come from? It came from the zoo. "You haven't been to the zoo in years." "No, I haven't." "So how did you get it?" This little spark of defiance that for years had been sort of floating around in the updrafts of my mind just found some dry brush, and it blazed into a fucking inferno. This is mine. Candy gave it to me. I have kept this secret for over half of my life for myself, and I'm not about to give this secret away to anyone, especially not my mom, who reliably found ways to insert herself into all of my successes and all of my accomplishments in the entertainment industry. All that stuff I worked so hard for that I never even wanted to do, and claim it all as her own. Well, this plastic elephant is mine, and it's gonna stay mine. I traded it for sex and drugs, Mom. It is full of drugs. Call the National Enquirer and I'll be on the cover. I picked up Candy's elephant and I struck this big, cheesy Barker's Beauty pose with it. Look, Mom, this is my brain on drugs. Quick, get the camera and grab a picture before I change my mind. Well, you don't have to be such a pill about it, she snapped. I'm just asking. Is it so terrible for a mother to be interested in her son? Yeah, about that. No, it would actually be really wonderful if you were interested in your son. Maybe you could talk to Dad about it. You guys can try out something new together. From across the house, the phone rang. Holy shit, I was literally saved by the bell. Debbie, my dad hollered. Phone! Nothing is more important than family, my mother admonished me on her way out of my bedroom. She's been saying that at me as long as I can remember. She still doesn't know what it means. I sat down at my desk and held Candy's elephant in my hands. I felt it get warm and soft before I gently put it back in a safe place. And I sang an Archie song to myself. This is part two. Ask me how I know. I think you know that I have been a Trekkie my entire life. Before and after I wore the uniform, created the nanites, trapped my mom in a collapsing warp bubble. This means that I have always enjoyed and currently participate in all the parts of fandom that we all love. From cosplay, you may have seen me last night in my Captain Kirk uniform, to fan fiction, I got paid to write fan fiction that was adapted into a comic book. I know. And I read the forums where my fellow nerds are talking about this universe that we all love so much. Now, this is going to come as a surprise to some of you in this room, but in the 80s and early 90s, it turns out Wesley Crusher was not the beloved icon that he is today. I know, it's shocking. It shocks the shit out of me, but it's true. For as long as Wesley Crusher has existed, even when he was just words on paper, long before there was an actor bringing him to life, there has been that guy. Capital T, capital G, that guy who has wondered loudly why Picard put Wesley, the teenager, at the helm of the Starship Enterprise. That's not the answer, but it is a answer that I will accept for half credit. When I was a kid, that guy was everywhere. He was everywhere I looked, online, at conventions, in the letters pages of Starlog. He was loud, he was strident, he was tireless, he was so angry, and he extended his enmity for the character to the young actor who played him. That guy drowned out any positive and uplifting voices that may have been in the air back then. That guy confirmed for me what I sincerely believed about myself, because it's what I had been taught at home. No matter what I did, no matter how good I was at it, It wasn't ever going to be good enough. I was never going to be good enough. Oh no, my pages are out of place. No, they're not. It was a real tough decade. It was a real tough decade, and a lot of it is recounted in my memoir, so I'm going to skip ahead a little bit to the part where I finally accepted what I think we all knew was true from the very beginning. The people who hated the idea of Wesley Crusher were massively outnumbered by the kids who adored and were inspired by him. Right? Yes, I know. Yes, we know. This is true. Put another way. The audience Gene Roddenberry wanted to bring to Star Trek in general and the Next Generation specifically with Wesley Crusher was too busy imagining themselves on the Enterprise with someone their own age and too young to write letters to Starlog and didn't have access to the button-making machine so they could make put Wesley in the airlock buttons and sell them at conventions. I bet some of those kids are adults in this room today. If you haven't done it yet, get your shingles vaccine. And you gotta schedule your colonoscopy. I know you don't wanna hear any of this, but guess what? If I have to deal with the fact that I'm 51, so do you. Okay, so I'm recently reading a thread in our Star Trek about, I think, Starfleet captains. It doesn't matter. What matters is this comment from someone who wondered why Picard put Wesley as the con when there are more qualified, experienced adults on board who deserve the spot. There must be an easier way to bang Wesley's mom without possibly endangering everyone on board because her kid doesn't know how to take the parking brake off and check his mirrors. So now this person, and I want to be very clear, this person is not that guy, okay? This person, this is what this person said. The better question is, how did this completely unqualified child get to actively pilot the flagship of the Federation while others had to attend the academy for years and get multiple placements before even being considered? This is an entirely fair question, apparently asked in good faith and not directed at me. It was an invitation to discuss the character and get into that stuff we love to get into when we talk about Star Trek. I never respond to things like this, but I actually know the canonical answer, and I'm a bit of an expert on the subject. So I felt like Wesley deserved someone to just speak up for him, and why not me? I said, okay, so disclosure, I am the actor who played Wesley Crusher. I have spent a great deal of time thinking about exactly this because angry nerds have been yelling at me about it for 30 years. Do you remember that a being of extraordinary power and ability pulled Captain Picard aside and said, "Dude, this kid is special. I can't tell you exactly why, but it's really important that you nurture and encourage him to the best of your ability. That's more than you should know, but now that you know it," and Picard listened. Picard heard this being who had literally taken them where no one has gone before, and he trusted that maybe this creature knows something Picard doesn't. This is what good leaders do. They listen. And because Picard listened, Wesley eventually becomes one of the travelers. Now, I'm sure that there are plenty of officers on the Enterprise who share your opinion. They are so pissed that this kid was promoted. They're so pissed that he's a Nepo baby. But they don't know what Picard knows. And Picard is the captain of the ship. So he gets to make the call. And he doesn't have to explain himself to anyone. Not bad for a Reddit comment off the top of my head. Thank you for your upvotes. I had some time to go a little bit deeper and opportunities to share some observations that may feel familiar to anyone who identified with Wesley Crusher the way I identified with Wesley Crusher. The traveler from Tau Ceti made it very clear to Picard that Wesley and Beverly must never know that Wesley is special. The crew and everyone else on the Enterprise must never know. Starfleet must never know.
David Cronenberg never knows.
So all of a sudden, Wesley is given this thing that he dreams of. And he absolutely knows that he hasn't yet earned it. How do you think this makes Wesley feel? I mean, we never saw it, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist within the character via the actor who played him, right? He wants to make Picard and his mom proud of him more than anything. And Picard promoted him to be a bridge officer. Holy crap, dream come true. But wait, what's happening now? What's going on? His peers are jealous of him and all the things he gets to do. The adults he's around when he isn't on the bridge quietly resent him for what they believe is unearned privilege. There's 1,000 people on the Enterprise, and Wesley probably knows like 24 of them. But everyone who sees him, they know him, they think. All they see is that Nepo baby. Wesley knows it, and Wesley feels it. He has massive imposter syndrome. He spends a lot of his time trying to understand why Captain Picard believed in him and gave him a chance. He can't understand why that isn't enough for everyone else. It's Captain Picard, man! He made the call! That should count! Wesley's dream has come true and he can't even celebrate it. Yeah, he's a full ensign, he's a Starfleet officer, but he's a kid who has never been to the academy and learned what being a Starfleet officer means. He's never learned how to behave and exist around other Starfleet officers who have gone through everything it takes to get posted on the lower decks of the Federation's flagship. He is wearing the uniform without having gained the experience that he needs to fill it and feel comfortable in it. He doesn't know that Picard and the Traveler did this. He just knows that now he's got to show up and prove to everyone that he actually does deserve it. And this kid, he's never been in a place like Starfleet Academy where it's safe and okay and expected to make mistakes and learn from them. And he knows that. At 15, it is a lot. Now this kid has to carry around with him not just the responsibility that comes with the con and the rank, but he has to exist on the Enterprise where he passes people in the corridors, sees people in the canteen, waits in line to use the transporter with all of these other officers who have never met him and deeply resent him for something he didn't even do. And Wesley feels that resentment. He feels it every single time, and it hurts like fucking hell. He will spend the rest of his time in Starfleet trying to prove to everyone that he was and is worthy of the promotion. And every single time he sits at the con, he knows that if he fucks up even a tiny little bit, everyone he loves could die. He carries that weight with him every second of every day. He feels it in every judgmental look, every whispered conversation, every challenge from a bully who's had one too many. And when he doesn't hear it from someone else, he hears it from the voice in his head. He can't escape it until he finally does. And it all makes sense. And 30 years of Earth time later, after he's spent more time being a traveler, seeing and doing things you wouldn't believe than he ever spent as a human, he'll hear someone complaining about how he got that promotion someone else really deserved way back then. And it's going to hurt him all over again. Because the body remembers, even when you're a traveler. Ask him how I know. Oh, that was a rhetorical question, sorry. You know, I tell people there's two things nerds are really good at: standing in line and following rules. At Gen Con one year, I came upon a line, and I was like, oh, I wonder what this line is for. And I'm walking along the side of the line. It goes down almost the entire block outside the convention center, and it's a line that has just formed behind a guy who's just sitting there waiting for someone. He's not waiting to go in anywhere. He's just sitting there with like a book, and there's a huge line behind him. Because it's like, it's our default state. What should we do? We should probably go get in that line. What's it for? I don't know, probably something important. There's a lot of people in it. The last bit of this is called See How We Are. When I'm not writing sad stories about my childhood, I host the Ready Room. The Ready Room is your official online destination for the Star Trek universe. I interview all the people who make modern Star Trek, including my castmates, my family, who are in Star Trek Picard. A little spoiler alert, I cameo at the end of season 2 in what is either the beautiful conclusion to Wesley's story or maybe the beginning of his third act. At this point, I'm very confident it's the former. But it is an infinite multiverse, so... When Star Trek Picard's third and final season had its fancy red carpet premiere at the Chinese Theater in Hollywood, I was invited, and I attended with my wife, Anne. We don't go out a lot, but the older we get, the more fun it is to sort of cosplay as adults in public. And I love Star Trek. I love my space family. You get it? The Chinese Theater is in what I think is the grossest and worst part of capital T tourist Hollywood. Don't ever go there. Unless you're like, boy, you know what I haven't done is really inhaled a mouthful of old urine. In which case, have I got a place for you guys to go. But this theater is legendary and historic, and having a premiere there is, to borrow a phrase, a big fucking deal. It is a palace. It seats about 900 people. It was packed with cast and crew, actors from every Star Trek series, pre- and post-production wizards, a couple of hundred incredibly enthusiastic Trekkies. The energy in this room was approaching the need for control rods. Before the screening began, after we had all been settled into our seats, Terry Metalis, who is the creator of Star Trek Picard Season 3, he is the reason I was able to see my entire space family back together again, and Alex Kurtzman, who is the executive producer of the entire Star Trek universe, they introduced the show. They thanked the cast and crew, and then they turned the spotlight over to my friend, who you all know as Sir Patrick Stewart, but I will always lovingly know as either Patrick or Old Baldy. He spoke lovingly and beautifully and eloquently about the entire experience in that gorgeous Sir Patrick Stewart way that we all love to witness. As he was wrapping up his remarks, he said, "I would like to ask the cast who are here to please stand up so they can be celebrated." Historically, at the milestone anniversaries and the other events where the cast was invited on stage, or asked to stand and be recognized, I was never included. Whether or not it was intentional, I still took it personally. It felt to me like someone, I think Rick Berman, was making sure I knew that there was the cast, and then there was me who left, who was not part of the cast. Look, I know there's a lot of Next Generation I'm not in, including all the movies. But I was there for an awful lot of it. And it always hurt to feel like I had been put on the other side of a locked door. But this night is not about me. This night is not even about the tiny little bit of season 2 that I'm in. This night is about season 3. This night is about celebrating the reunion of my Star Trek family who all came together for what is likely their final mission. So I was happy to stay in my seat while they started to stand up. I clapped so hard for them, my hands were vibrating the next morning. I applauded not just for their work on that season, but for everything they have given to Star Trek and us and me for over 30 years. I celebrated the absolute hell out of my space family. And while I was doing this, I glanced across the aisle at Frakes, and I clapped like hell at him. We made eye contact, and he gives me this incredulous look. "Why are you sitting down? Stand up, W." He said this over the applause that was beginning to thunder. People around me began to murmur, "Stand up, stand up." So I did. And he applauded me. And I may have wept. I may have wept a little bit, or maybe a lot. I can't remember. I was just so grateful. I was so grateful to be included in the moment by this man who has always been more of a dad to me than my dad ever was, even when he didn't know it. And my dad never made an effort to get to know me. This is a choice he made. It's not some weird personality quirk. I know because I watched him put a lot of effort into knowing and loving my brother and sister. But I have always, always felt loved and accepted by Franks. He's always been there for me. He's always made sure that I know that I am part of a family. Later, at the after party, I was saying goodnight, and he said, "What were you doing? What are you doing sitting down like that? What were you thinking?" "Johnny, this isn't about me. This is about you guys. I didn't want to..." "No. No," he said. And he put his hand on my shoulder. And he said, "This is about us." I felt so seen and so loved. And I had to take a very deep breath to force those tears back. And I said, "Thank you for including me, Johnny. You are the best dad I never got to have." Thank you all so much for coming tonight.
Have a wonderful rest of your cruise. Get home safely. Live long and happy.